MacCast, Sunday, November 4th, 2012. Hey, Mac Geeks, it's time for your MacCast, the show for Mac Geeks by Mac Geeks. I'm Adam, and this is the show where we discuss all things Macintosh. How you doing? Welcome back to the MacCast. Glad to have you back once again. We've got a big show for you this week. Of course, last week on Friday, Apple shipped their new iPads, the iPad Mini, along with the fourth generation, the updated version of the full-size iPad. We're going to be talking about that, talking about a little bit about how sales went over the weekend. Also going to be looking into some details on Apple's Fusion drives that came out in the new Mac Minis. Those have been taken apart and analyzed, so we're getting some more details there. And then another big story from last week, the restructuring of Apple's executive team. So we're going to get into all of that. I also have tips and tricks and questions from you and a little bit of commentary on the tablet market in general. Steve Ballmer made some comments this week that I want to discuss a little bit. So we're going to get into all of that in just a moment. But before we get started, I do want to take a quick moment and thank one of our show sponsors, and that's Citrix. You know, I believe a big part of being successful in business is the ability to communicate, to collaborate, to be able to work as a team. And discussing plans, sharing ideas, and bringing those ideas to life are important, and meetings can be an effective tool for making that happen. The trouble is, in this day and age, you've got clients, you've got colleagues working from different offices, maybe even on the go, and meeting in person can sometimes feel like it's impossible. And that's unless you have a tool like GoToMeeting with HD Faces. It's a powerfully simple way to meet and collaborate online. And GoToMeeting with HD Faces gives your team the ability to share the same screen, which makes it much easier for everyone to get on the same page. Plus, you get to see each other's faces, so nothing gets lost in your communication. And the most awesome thing, I think, is that it's so easy to launch and join a meeting from anywhere. You can use your computer, you can use your phone, you can use your tablet, and you can even present from your iPad. So it doesn't matter where you are, where your clients are, or where your colleagues are located, you can hold effective and awesome meetings with GoToMeeting with HD Faces. I use GoToMeeting with my clients in my web business, and it's such an efficient and effective tool. It literally pays for itself in the amount of time that I save. And you can try it free for 30 days. All you have to do is visit GoToMeeting.com, click on the Try It Free button, and make sure you use the promo code MACCAST. GoToMeeting, meeting is believing, and a big thank you to them for their support of the MacCast. So as I mentioned at the top of the show, Apple's iPad Mini and the new fourth generation iPad went on sale this past Friday. And in looking at the reports, it looks like the crowds at the Apple stores seemed to be a little bit smaller, much lower by some reports. And I'm not really sure if that's because of pre-orders, because of general lack of enthusiasm over the new products. Maybe people are just feeling saturation with the new iPad coming out just about 7-8 months after the original one. I'm not sure exactly what it is. I think also, though, with the holidays approaching, we might see a little bit of more of a slow burn on this one in terms of sales, with the bigger numbers resulting in December as people buy new iPads as gifts for the holiday season. But only time is going to tell on that one. But many stores, I guess, you could walk into right after the launch and simply pick up your iPad Mini. The one notable exception, which was a little bit surprising given the weather, the big storm that happened, was the Fifth Avenue store in New York City. They actually sold out in about 2 hours. They had a pretty good crowd. I think it was estimated around 800 to maybe 900 folks showed up, and they sold out in just about 2 hours. So that was an amazing turnout. As far as my thoughts on the Mini, my Mini arrived, and I opened it up, did a little unboxing. You can actually see my images and video up on the Facebook page for the MacCast. So that's facebook.com/themaccast. But the biggest complaint I think most people are having is that the screen is not Retina. It's not a Retina display. Most people, though, myself included, don't see this really as a deal breaker. You know, I looked at the screen, and when you compare it side by side with the Retina, it's very noticeable. But when you're just using it without any kind of reference point, and I've been using my Retina iPad for, you know, 8 months now, 7-8 months now, it wasn't really a big deal to me. And it's going to be even less of a deal for someone who's never owned a Retina device. So I don't think that that's a killer. It is one of those specs, though, that the competitors are going to continue to point to as a deficiency. And for some people, it will be a huge deal breaker. It'll be the one reason they'll never buy an iPad mini, or wait at least until the iPad mini gets a Retina upgrade, which by some accounts might happen in the spring. I'm hoping that's not the case and that Apple doesn't kind of move into this yearly update cycle for iPads. But at this point, I think all bets are off with them updating the new iPad to the fourth generation. I think we don't know what they're going to do. I don't think it's going to happen, but it could. But, you know, the iPad mini is also a smaller device. So while it's still only 163 pixels per inch, those actual physical pixels are much smaller than the ones on the iPad 2. So a lot of people are comparing the screen to the iPad 2 screen because that was the last generation iPad that didn't have Retina. What happens, though, is since the physical pixels are so much smaller, at the same viewing distances, those pixels are going to be less distinguishable. So while it's not as crisp and sharp as you might get with a Retina screen, I do think it's a little bit better than the non-Retina screen that's on the iPad 2. And as far as colors go, and looking at mine, I think the colors are bright and vibrant, might have a little bit better color consistency and accuracy than the iPad 2, which was still pretty darn good. So I think the screen is very adequate. As a matter of fact, one report I read said that the Retina pixels on the iPad 4 are just about a third smaller than the pixels that are on the mini. So there are less of them, but they're pretty densely packed in there and pretty small. So distinguishing between the individual pixels at, again, standard viewing distances is going to be a little bit tricky. I even took my new iPad mini and sort of put it side by side right next to my Retina iPad third generation and compared video playback side by side. And for color consistency, I actually liked the color on the iPad mini a little bit better than my iPad 3, even though it had slightly less brightness. So I had to bring the brightness up on the iPad mini just a hair higher to sort of match similar brightness on the new iPad. So overall, very happy with the screen. I think it's very adequate, and I think a lot of people are going to be perfectly fine with it. The iPad mini is the first iPad to have stereo speakers, which I immediately wanted to test those out as well. They're very nice. I was surprised at how loud the speakers can get. You can get some good volume out of those teeny tiny speakers. They do distort slightly when you get them up to full volume. So I don't think you can totally crank them, and depending upon the music and what you're listening to, your results may vary. But overall, I was pretty impressed. Seemed to have pretty good range, decent bass. I'm not a huge bass fan, so I'm maybe not the person to ask or evaluate that. But for me, for my usage, I thought they were pretty good speakers. As far as actual performance of the GPU, a lot of people were worried about that two-year-old A5 that's in there. I have to say it holds up pretty well. Overall, I didn't notice it feeling sluggish or slow. I did have some scrolling and lagging issues in the purchased apps section of the App Store. As I was trying to load up my applications, I did it over the air, you know, just downloaded it over my Wi-Fi network. So I went into the App Store, went into my purchase tab, and was downloading individual applications. And I have, you know, several hundred applications in my list. So scrolling through that list did get a little bit laggy, but I'm not entirely convinced that was the iPad mini's fault. I think it may have more to do with how the App Store is working and how it's loading. You know, it's basically loading web pages. So it was a lot of data. It was a big list of stuff to load. And I think as images and stuff were coming in, it was sort of slowing down the scrolling experience on the iPad mini. I'm going to have to use it a little bit more. But overall, I've been playing games on it. I've been doing a lot of reading and research. And I haven't noticed any issues whatsoever with the performance. The big news, though, for me, and I think for a lot of people, is that the size and the weight on the iPad mini are just about perfect. It does actually fit in one hand. It actually fits in one hand better than I thought. I thought I was going to really have to stretch my fingers to get it to fit, but it's comfortable. I can hold it in one hand. It's not my preferred way to hold it. I actually am finding that I prefer to hold it sort of just pinched with my hand behind it and my thumb on the bezel. And I will tell you that the touch rejection that Apple has built into iOS 6 works great. I haven't had any false touches. Overall, the device, extremely light, very thin. It feels really nice in your hand. I love the materials, the metal. It's a rock solid device, and it definitely doesn't compromise on screen size. So even though the physical dimensions of the device are smaller than a lot of the competing 7-inch tablets, the fact that Apple was able to squeeze that 7.9-inch, almost 8-inch screen in there, really, I do think makes a difference. It you know, putting it right next, again, to the new iPad, the screen's not that much smaller, but you have a much smaller device. The only downside to that, I would say, is that occasionally some of the user interface elements in some applications do feel a little bit small. Also, occasionally type is a little bit small, a little bit harder to read, especially on those apps where you can't adjust the type size. Thinking specifically like magazines are going to be a little bit of an issue. I have a subscription to Wired magazine on Newsstand. I tried that, and because it's just basically an image that's loading, you can't adjust the font size. Some articles and some smaller fonts were a little bit harder to read. That probably is one of those areas where you'll see a deficiency of the non-Retina screen. Had it had a Retina screen, the edges on the smaller font sizes might be a little bit crisper, a little bit tighter, and a little bit easier to read. But overall, I really haven't had any issues reading text or interacting with elements. And so my general consensus is that, again, even though it seems like in-store sales day one were a little bit slow, I think as reviews come out and more people hear how good this device is and how well it holds up and actually exceeds, I think, a lot of the competitive 7-inch tablets that are out there, even with a higher price point, I think people are really going to absolutely fall in love with this device. If I were Apple, I'd be a little bit concerned about it eating or eroding sales away from the other iPads, but I don't think actually that is even something that Apple's even worried about. I think they're happy as long as they're selling iPads to people. They don't care whether you're getting the big one or the small one. They're just going to sell a ton of all of them. And this is a really nice new lineup. I had really doubted it. I have to be honest. I had really doubted Apple ever needed to do a 7-inch iPad. But now, having played with it, having seen one, I think it was a right move. It was a good direction to go in. Now, for me personally, I think I'm going to continue, because I do a lot of writing and content creation, I'm probably going to stick with my new iPad, my third generation iPad. My wife is already kind of laying claim to the iPad mini. She's immediately fallen in love with it. She said we can get rid of her old iPad 2. So that may be going up for sale. That might show up on Gazelle here at the end of the week. We'll have to see. I think I've just lost my iPad mini. But at least I got to test it out for you and give you some of my thoughts and opinions. But let's talk a little bit about that new iPad, the fourth generation iPad. Actually, some of the reviews, now that they've done the teardown and kind of looked at it, a lot of people are really calling it the 3.5 generation iPad, because there's not a lot of huge differences in here. You got the same screen. You do have the new A6 chip, and we're starting to get some details about that A6X chip. They've done the analysis. I think ChipWorks has done their X-raying thing. And what they know now is it does use a 32 nanometer process. It still is a Samsung chip, but I have a feeling we're going to see Apple moving away from Samsung as the fabricator on those chips. But even though it still uses the 32 nanometer process, it is 30% larger. So physically, it is a bigger chip. And the reason for that seems to be not the CPUs, because it still uses the same number of CPU cores as the A6 processor, but it has those quad 4 GPUs. And there was one theory that the A6 might be using the same Imagination Technologies PowerVR SGX 543 MP4 GPUs as were in the A5X, but they would just be clocked up. Now, AnandTech believes that Apple may be using a more powerful PowerVR SGX 554 MP4 GPU, and that may account for the larger die size or the larger size of the A6X processor. So, needless to say, what that translates into is exactly what Apple has advertised, that it's double the speed on the CPU and double the speed on the GPU, which is going to mean a lot for developers, especially developers who are doing games and more processor and specifically GPU intensive tasks. The original chip that Apple put in, the A5X, was really all about just driving the pixels in the new Retina display. Now you've got extra horsepower that can actually be used by the system and used by applications and go beyond just making Retina work. So it's going to be interesting to see what happens. I think in the short run, it's not going to mean a lot, but in the long run, it could mean we see, you know, more and more stuff happening with games, especially on the newer iPads. And then one interesting thing about the iPad mini when it shipped, as well as the fourth generation iPad, is that Apple no longer seems to be bundling headphones in with the iPads. No more earbuds. You don't get the new EarPods. You don't get anything. And I was a little bit disappointed by that. I think that, in my mind, is Apple cheaping out a little bit too much. I know they've done this sort of thing in the past. I remember back in the days when, you know, iPods were shipping, they used to come with a dock, and then at one point Apple took the dock out. So they do tend to, as they release new products, sort of take out some of the accessories as a cost savings measure. But I think taking out earbuds is just something that they shouldn't be doing. Another thing to note is on the iPad mini, Apple ships just the little 5-watt power adapter. And I don't know if that was just to keep the box size down or, again, if that's a cost-saving measure, because they do now have a brand new 12-watt power adapter, and the iPad mini will support that. It'll actually charge faster with a 12-watt wall adapter, but Apple ships just the 5-watt. So you're going to have a little bit slower charging if you're using that. You may consider buying the new 12-watt adapter if you want to get faster charging on your new iPad mini. The fourth gen iPad does seem to have the new charger, I believe. So that's what we know so far about the new iPads. If you received a new iPad mini and you want to chime in with some of your comments, if you upgraded or maybe bought a new fourth generation iPad, I'd love to get your opinions on that as well. You can send those to maccast@gmail.com. As far as sales predictions, those are starting to come out now too. Everybody wondering, and we will probably find out next week, or actually probably tomorrow by the time you hear this. So these numbers may already be out. We will likely know the first weekend sales numbers. Apple tends to release those right after the first weekend, but analysts are already making informed predictions. As a matter of fact, Apple Insider has KGI analyst Ming-Chi Kuo predicting first weekend sales of 850,000 units. I think Gene Munster was a little bit more aggressive. He's thinking 1 million to maybe 1.5 million units. And those numbers to me may seem low given the comparison against the third generation iPad numbers, which I think in the opening weekend fell around 3 million. But part of the reason for that that's being speculated is it may be that Apple just couldn't produce that many minis. That might be all that was available. According to Quo, his supply chain checks estimated that Apple started manufacturing only in mid-October and was able to produce somewhere around 950,000 units for the launch. Another thing that Apple did is they did roll out the Mini in 34 countries. This is the biggest international rollout Apple has done on an iOS product to date. And once again, you'd think that would lend itself to higher numbers, but that's not what we're hearing from the analysts. It is predicted, though, over the holiday quarter that Apple will outperform their competitors. Quo predicts that there will be 8.2 million iPad minis sold for the holiday quarter, followed by about 4.5 million Kindle Fire HDs and maybe 1.9 million Nexus 7s. And this is, again, I think, is the 7-inch form factor tablets. So Apple's still set to sort of double, if not quadruple, the numbers that we're seeing from the nearest competitors. Now, I will say that Quo's numbers are for the entire quarter are a little bit more aggressive than some of the other analysts. Most analysts are estimating iPad mini numbers for the December quarter to fall somewhere in the range of 5 to 7 million units. But regardless of where we end up, it looks for right now, most Apple retail stores are reporting that the iPad mini is sold out. Because of that, Apple has opened up their personal pickup service. So if you haven't picked up an iPad mini and you're planning to do so, probably the best way to get it now is to go online to Apple's site between 10 p.m. and 4 a.m. There you can do a check of availability at your local retail store. You can put your order in online and then arrange for next day pickup at an Apple store. So you'll be able to see which stores have stock and which units they have, and you'll be able to order that up. And that service does also work through the app, the App Store app for your iOS device. So you can also order from there, again, between 10 p.m. and 4 a.m. If you don't want to have to go in and wait in line or potentially get to a store and find out that they're out of stock, you can pre-plan things. So that's a great tip for you. And if you do go out and get a new iPad mini, you probably want to bring it home, hook it up to iTunes or your Wi-Fi network and run a software update, because Apple did slip out this past week an update to iOS 6, iOS 6.0.1. According to the release notes, it fixes a bug that prevented the iPhone 5 from installing software updates wirelessly over the air. Interesting thing about that is you can still do an over-the-air update on your iPhone 5. What'll happen if you go to software update is on the device is you'll get a little message about installing an application. It will download and install an updater application that will then allow you to install the fix that'll allow you to wirelessly update iOS 6 over the air. I know it sounds confusing, but it does all work. It's actually how I upgraded my iPhone 5, didn't connect it to iTunes. So you can do it that way, but that is one of the fixes that's in there. Also, according to the release notes, fixes a bug where horizontal lines may be displayed across the keyboard. It fixes an issue that could cause the camera flash not to go off. Improves reliability of the iPhone 5 and the 5th generation iPod Touch when connecting to encrypted WPA2 Wi-Fi networks. So that's good news. I did see one report saying that it's not fixing Wi-Fi connectivity issues in iOS 6 for all users. So we'll have to get some more details if you're continuing to have Wi-Fi connection issues with your iOS device running iOS 6. Let us know and we'll try and see if there aren't some other workarounds. It resolves an issue that prevents the iPhone from using the cellular network in some instances. Well, that would be annoying, so that's a good fix in there. Consolidates the use cellular data switch for iTunes Match. This is a nice one because there were actually two places where you'd have to go set that, and I could never figure out which one should be on. One would be on, one would be off, but it didn't seem to matter. As long as one was on, it was working. So that confusion is now gone. It fixes a passcode lock bug, which would sometimes allow access to the passbook passes from the lock screen, something you probably don't want if your device gets lost or stolen. Fixes a bug affecting Exchange meetings. So I know there were some Exchange server issues. So if you use Exchange server in your business and you use an iPhone, you're probably going to want to grab this update. And then there's now a larger report a problem button in the Maps app, making it easier to submit to Apple any issues with the Maps application. And they really do want to get that feedback because they're really working hard to try and improve the Apple Maps. Someone noted also that there's a redesigned lock screen player on the iPod Touch. Now, I haven't seen this, but they had a screenshot, and it appears like when you are on the home screen and you double tap the, or on the lock screen, excuse me, and double tap the home button to bring up those controls, they're much more spread out, and they look more like they do, I guess, in the podcast application. I haven't seen that. It doesn't seem to be an update that made its way to the iPhone 5. When I access the lock screen controls for the iPod or for the music player, I still see the same kind of old controls. So I guess that one might be something that's exclusive to the iPod Touch. Another nice thing is that iOS 6.0.1 seems to add the iPad mini's accidental near bezel touch rejection stuff to the full-sized iPads as well, and possibly also to the iPhone and maybe even the iPod Touches. After updating, I noticed that I could grab my iPhone, especially in iBooks. This is where I most often saw the issues with accidental touches near the bezel. In iBooks, if I would touch the side of my screen, sometimes it would start flipping through the pages over and over, and it was really annoying. That doesn't seem to happen anymore since upgrading to iOS 6.0.1. So that was a nice little surprise in this update. And in addition to the iOS 6 update, Apple also did update a few of their other applications. Safari 6.0.2 came out, iPhoto 9.4.2, and Aperture 3.4.2. Now, on the photo applications, the updates seem to be about adding the ability to drag items from your libraries directly into your photo stream, so you can now add stuff into your photo stream. You can also now paste in more than one email address when using the share with option. There are a bunch of other updates in there. Aperture seems to have a much longer list of improvements than iPhoto, but those two updates are available, so if you use iPhoto or Aperture, you're going to want to grab those. And the Safari update appears to be mostly about some security fixes, so that's always a good thing as well. If you haven't run your software update on your Mac, you probably want to go into System Preferences and do that, grab all these updates, and of course, run your updates on iOS 6. This next story may sound more like the plot from a upcoming James Cameron movie, but Androids are on the rise. In the third quarter, Android-based smartphones accounted for 75% of all smartphone shipments, according to the latest figures from IDC. That growth represents an astounding 91.5% year-over-year gain. So Android is picking up steam very quickly. For the iPhone and iOS, they saw year-over-year growth as well. Apple shipped 26.9 million units, according to the report, and garnered a 14.9% share of the market. That gave Apple a year-over-year growth of 57.3%. So not too shabby, but not quite a 91.5% number like Android. Apple's third quarter numbers, though, may be slightly lower since it's believed that some people probably held off making purchases waiting for the release of the iPhone 5. So we actually might see some of those share gains increase for Apple in the December quarter. We're going to have to wait a little bit on that one. And while you may think that the Android number is the number to beat, actually percentage-wise, Windows Phone saw a huge year-over-year jump, even bigger than Android's jump of 91.5%. Windows Phone jumped 140% year-over-year. The bad news about that is that Windows Phone still only accounts for 1.2% of all smartphone shipments. So still the smallest player in the smartphone business, but with Windows Phone 8 being out now, we could see that grow. And as far as where the growth is coming from for Apple, Android, and Windows, it's all seeming to be at the expense of the competitors. BlackBerry and Symbian both saw year-over-year decreases in their market share, according to the report. At Apple's special event for the iPad mini that they held just a couple weeks ago, they not only gave us new iPads, but they also gave us some new Mac models. including the Mac Minis and the new iMacs. And as part of that, they had Apple's Fusion Drives as a build-to-order option. Well, the Mac Minis with the Fusion Drives have started shipping, and they started arriving at different locations, and sites like Ars Technica are doing a breakdown to see exactly how does that Fusion Drive work and what makes it tick. And for those of you who missed it or who don't know what a Fusion Drive is, well, it combines 128 gigabytes of flash storage, solid-state storage, with a 1 terabyte or a 3 terabyte traditional hard drive. And then what happens is software in macOS 10 Mountain Lion intelligently monitors and manages the files and applications that you're using and dynamically moves the most frequently accessed stuff to the solid state storage. So it takes it off of the slower spindle drive, moves it into that flash storage, increasing the performance of your system without having to have a huge flash drive, which can add a lot of cost and be much more expensive. To the operating system and to your applications, though, those two drives are presented as one single volume. And Ars Technica was able to confirm that Apple is using OS X's core storage technology to actually make that happen. They've also discovered that, contrary to early rumors, and I think I even reported on this on the MacCast, that Disk Utility only sees the single storage volume. It does not see separate volumes. It was thought that maybe you could go into Disk Utility and actually see the separate 128 gigs of flash storage. That turns out to not be the case. The only way that you can verify that they are truly separate bits of storage is to use the Disk Utility command in the terminal. And there you can see the two different parts of the Fusion Drive. Actually, it gets presented as three disks, the two physical volumes, and then there's a third core storage volume. That's the one that ends up getting presented to the operating system. So you have disk 0, disk 1, and disk 2, respectively, representing the flash, the HDD, and then this core storage volume that's created by the operating system. If you go into Apple's system information, you can also see that the Fusion Drive has this sort of split personality. So you'll see the two portions, the SSD or flash portion and the HDD or the hard drive volume sitting there in the system information. And because the technology is all built into OS X and the Disk Utility command, this technology for creating this physical core storage volume, or this virtual core storage volume, I guess is probably a more accurate way to say it. It's been revealed that you actually can use the same technique on your own SSD drive and hard drive equipped Mac. So if you have an SSD and a hard drive in your Mac, you could go in and you could create your own Fusion Drive in essence. Now, there's no GUI-based tool for actually doing that, and the process for doing it is not for the faint of heart. You have to go into the terminal command. You have to kind of know what you're doing. There's a very specific procedure for setting it up, but it has been verified that you can do it. Doing it on your own, of course, wouldn't be supported by Apple. Apple is only offering the feature on the new Macs with the Fusion Drives built in. So at this point, it's really not known how reliable it would be. There could be some gotchas in there, but early testing seems to indicate that you could technically do it. And even with an Apple-supported Fusion Drive, it's also assumed, I think, at this point, that if there's any kind of data corruption, either on the flash storage portion or the hard drive portion, you would actually have to restore from backup and rebuild the entire system, the entire Fusion volume, to get things back up and running. So very cool technology, and there's promise that maybe hopefully someday Apple will give us a GUI tool, build something maybe in even into Disk Utility to allow us to create our own Fusion drives through the operating system using third-party drives rather than the stuff that we buy from Apple. So that's kind of cool. And then finally for today, I guess I'm really burying the lead. Apple restructured their executive team this past week. It was probably the biggest news story of the week. Tim Cook came out. He released a letter to employees as well as a press release went out saying that John Browett, who was in charge of Apple Retail, is going to be leaving the company. Scott Forrestal, who was in charge of iOS, is going to be leaving the company. And that last one in particular is a shocker. Actually, they're both kind of shockers, because Brout was only with the company for about 5 months. Forrestal's been around and been there since the early days when Steve Jobs came back. He actually worked with Steve Jobs over at Next. But there were some inklings that something might be off with Scott when he wasn't up on stage presenting at the iPad mini event. And so Tim Cook is going to assume the roles for Browett in terms of Apple retail until Apple can find a replacement. Forrestal is actually going to be remaining with the company, it sounds like, through the end of the year, and he's just simply listed as an advisor to Tim Cook. It's not really clear what his role is going to be. And then as far as his prior duties and responsibilities, they're actually being divided up amongst a number of different executives. Actually, overall, it looks like what Apple's doing is sort of reorganizing the top level so that they have one high-level executive sort of in charge of these different, I'd almost call them silos, these different divisions. And it actually is more logically structured in my mind. So what's happening is you're going to have Jonathan Ive in charge of all of the design. He's actually going to oversee both hardware and software. There's a new interface group that's going to be in charge of all the software elements. So that would be iOS, OS X, and Apple's software. And so that's going to, I think, bring in a cohesive design. You're going to have a cohesive vision across the design of all of the hardware and software. And this is sort of the strategy Apple seems to be taking across the board. So Craig Federighi is going to oversee all of the operating system development. So that now includes iOS. He was just doing OS X and Forrestal was iOS. Now he'll oversee OS X and iOS, as well as software development of Apple's applications. So you can see with one guy at the top, he's going to have a broad vision across all the different platforms, across all the different versions of the software. And I think that's going to lend itself to creating more integrated, more cohesive products across the board for Apple. On the services side, that's all going to be falling to Eddie Q. So that's things like the app stores, iCloud, which Eddie has already been in charge of, and then he's now taking on Maps and Siri, which both have significant cloud services elements to them, so that makes a lot of sense. Bob Mansfield, who had left Apple, who had announced he was retiring from Apple, they kind of had to pull him back in. He is now officially back at Apple for 2 years. He's going to be heading up a new technologies group, which is going to handle all of the wireless stuff. So that would be the wireless chipsets and wireless technology that's built into Apple's iOS devices. And he's also going to be in charge of all of the teams handling chip development. So all of Apple's A series processors for their iOS devices. And I think it's lending some credence to this rumor that Apple is thinking about developing its own chips for future Macs. So Mansfield would, in theory, be overseeing all of that development. And then the guy that replaced Bob Mansfield, Dan Riccio, is going to be the guy in charge of hardware across the board. So Macs and iOS devices are going to fall under his realm. And I would imagine he's backed up a little bit by Mansfield during the transition. So a very strong team of people. But it's great because they're going to cross-collaborate, I think, a lot more. And once again, that's going to create this great integration between all of Apple's products, which is already really good, but I think it's going to get better under this sort of new structure that Tim Cook has put into place. And of course, you've got Tim up there at the top overseeing all of his teams. And it seems like a really nice top-down structure at this point, and it'll be fun to see where Apple takes it. Reportedly, you know, one genesis for all this was that Forrestal was really a source of friction within the executive team. Some say that he wouldn't even hold meetings with Jonathan Ive unless Tim Cook was there. Tim had to be present to sort of moderate between the team, which that just can't be a fun way to be running a company, especially at the executive level. Also, some say that Forrestal, since he's on his way out now, that was the reason why Mansfield was more willing to commit to returning to Apple on an official basis. It wasn't the reason, you know, it wasn't a problem if Forrestal stayed around. Mansfield was still going to be there, but more on this sort of temporary level. Now that Forrestal's on the way out, I guess he felt more comfortable remaining on for a couple years and working with the team that Apple has in place now. So I think overall, really great news for Apple, but it was a little bit of a shocking shakedown of the company. And I, you know, Forrestal, I just want to comment. I did a longer episode for MacCast members on my thoughts on the whole executive restructuring, but I think he's getting a lot of flack. And I think people are forgetting all the great things that he did with iOS and sort of bringing the platform forward. He's also been around with the company for a number of years. He has a lot of significant influence into OS X and where it's come to. So we do need to give him a little bit of credit. It's going to be interesting to see where he goes. There's no news on where Browett or Forrestal may end up, but I'm sure we'll be hearing about that in the future. And with that, that's going to do it for this episode. Or no, it's not for the episode. Wait, we've got a lot more episode to get to. That's going to do it for the news for this week. But before we move on, I do want to take a moment and thank another one of our show sponsors, and that's Gazelle. Hey, are you considering getting a new iPad, maybe an iPad mini, or maybe a new iPhone? If you are, what are you going to do with your old device? One option you have is to sell that device to Gazelle for cash, and that would be cash you can use to purchase your upgrade. And they make it really simple and fast. All you have to do is go to gazelle.com, G-A-Z-E-L-L-E.com. Tell them a little bit about the condition of your device. Heck, they'll even buy a broken iPhone or an iPad and still give you cash for it in a lot of cases. And when you do that, you'll get a risk-free offer for your old technology, and Gazelle will lock that offer in for 30 days. They'll even send you a box that you can send your item back in and pay the shipping. So they make it super simple. And once they receive your device, they'll check it out and you get paid quickly by cash or PayPal. And it's truly, truly risk-free. MacCast listener Mike, as a matter of fact, emailed me to let me know he got an offer on his iPhone 3G. He listed it originally in poor condition, and when he sent it in to Gazelle, they evaluated it because they get these things in. Their team evaluates it. They'll even wipe off your data that's on it, but you probably want to do that before you send it in, but they'll do it for you. And when they looked at Mike's device, they decided the condition was better than Mike had said it was, and they turned around and they doubled his offer. So he ended up with more than he thought he would. And while this doesn't happen every time, it's nice to know that they handle each case like that. They look at it, they evaluate it, and if it's worth more, they're going to give you more. And not only that, when they make you an offer, it's locked for 30 days. So you can get that offer now, and typically items are going to go down in value over time, so you don't want to wait. You can lock that in. You can even go out and buy your new device now, and then once you have the new device, send in your old one, and then you'll get paid. So you don't have to live without a device, right? Oftentimes you got to send it in, got to wait for the money to come back, and then go get your new device. You don't have to do that with Gazelle. So what's your iPhone or your iPad worth? You can find out now. Just take a minute, go to gazelle.com, and a big thank you to them for their support of the MacCast. On a recent show, I told you about a listener who uses his iTunes library and a playlist to actually print out a set list for his band. And one of the columns that's in that set list is the key that they're going to be playing a particular song in. And the trouble with printing out the list from iTunes is that the key data is hard to read because the font in iTunes, or the font that iTunes uses, the particularly C character and G characters look very similar. The G doesn't have the little crossbar on it. So it makes it a little bit difficult, especially when you're, you know, at a club or whatever, it is dimly lit. It makes it hard to see whether it's a C or a G. And so he was wondering if there was a way to adjust the font, to use a different font that was maybe a little easier to distinguish those two characters. And I offered up a hack because I really didn't find a good way to adjust that. And my hack involved actually going in and altering iTunes, the application itself, digging in and getting to a plist file to change the font. And that really wasn't the best method. It got the job done, but could potentially mess up your iTunes. So I wasn't really happy with that. And a MacCast listener emailed me and gave me a much easier solution. I had really overthought this whole thing. He said, why don't you just use copy and paste? I thought, oh, well, because that's just too easy, right? You know, you can actually, and I forgot about this, you can actually go into the view in iTunes, set up all the columns that you want in the list view, and then simply select them all and copy and paste that information into Pages, into Numbers, into any other text application. And what you end up with is a tab delineated result. So in Numbers, it'll actually go right into the columns. And at that point, you could format it however you want. You could use whatever font you want. You can print it out. Do whatever you want with it. And I thought that was just brilliant. You know, sometimes the simplest answers are the best ones. And I unfortunately I forgot who sent in that tip, so if that was you, thank you very much. And hopefully that'll be a little bit simpler for you all to implement. Now I feel like I have to opinionate a little bit. Is that a word? Or pontificate? I don't know exactly how we want to say it. Basically, I want to complain about something that Steve Ballmer said this week. And I know Steve Ballmer, right? He's always coming out and saying these sort of outlandish things. But this week, something really got me kind of going. I actually was, I think, screaming at my iPad when I read this quote. But this past week, he said something to the effect that, you know, neither Apple nor Amazon nor Google, nobody has a product, meaning a tablet product, that you can use that lets you work and play. They don't have a product that can be your tablet and your PC. And he was referring basically to the advantages that Microsoft feels the Surface has, and that the bipolar nature of Windows 8 is attempting to sort of bridge this gap between desktops and tablets, sort of merging them into a single device. So something that lets you play as well as get work done, much in the same way that a PC would. So I don't know how exactly different that is than a PC. And this is starting to feel like, you know, they're trying to merge tablets and notebooks into this single device. And it feels like this area where Microsoft has been before, right? They actually pioneered, and they get some credit for this, they pioneered the tablet computer with pen-based hybrid systems, right? And so I'm thinking about this concept of sort of merging these two things, and it feels to me like they've been there before, right? And why is it going to work better for them now? And I'm not really sure. And so I want to, you know, give them the benefit of the doubt, and I decided to go in this week. Actually, Dave Sparks, Mac Sparky from Mac Power Users, and I have a standing dinner every couple months. We get together. We had this dinner and we were near the Microsoft store, so we decided to go in and play with the Surface, check it out and see what was going on with it. And it was also a little experiment to see how the employees were going to sort of market to us this new device. And I have to say, we went in, the immediate reaction was the hardware is actually pretty nice. It's boxy. It lends itself to that sort of PC feel. It's kind of squared off on the sides and stuff like that, but it has additional ports and it has an expansion slot and it has some nice things. And the touch keyboard cover, I have to say, is a really nice innovation. Actually, tactile wise, in terms of typing on it, it felt very similar to typing on the screen. Of course, it's a little bit softer because it's a softer material, but it does add extra room to typing since you don't have to take up that space on the screen. So you get more screen real estate and you have a similar style typing surface. I didn't find it particularly any easier to type on the touch keyboard, but it definitely gave you some more area. And so my first thought was, well, this is a pretty nice device. It seems like a nice offering. But then you start to get in and you start to try and do more stuff with it. And aesthetically and functionally, you start to realize that exactly what Microsoft is sort of saying, that this is meant to be some sort of merging of the PC and the tablet, it really ends up being true. And what comes through, and David Sparks commented on this, and I thought it was really smart, is that Microsoft, in terms of how it's presenting the Surface in and of itself, and I don't mean in terms of their marketing, I mean in terms of the physical device and its design and the design of the software, it really feels like it's trying to be a laptop replacement more than anything else. Everything screams that it is designed to be used in landscape mode. So it can be used in portrait, but when you do, it just feels awkward. It feels awkward from a device standpoint. It's really tall. It's a 16 by 9, and the aspect ratio just gets a little bit weird when you've got it in landscape in portrait mode, excuse me. The software doesn't seem to really take advantage of the portrait layouts, and it's awkward even down to the way it transitions. When you turn it, it kind of takes a second. It's a little bit laggy, and it just sort of flashes and comes back into view in the different mode. And in portrait, the elements just don't feel like they want to be there. Sort of interacting with it doesn't feel right, and it's just feels stretched out. It's not even that there's a lot of space. It's really hard to quantify. You almost have to see it to really understand it. But then you go back to the design aesthetic of the hardware itself, things like the kickstand, and the kickstand only works in landscape mode. So it's sort of saying, if you're going to use the kickstand, you got to use it in landscape. The keyboard cover only works in landscape mode. So all of these elements kind of come together to say, this is a laptop replacement. So it's not really meant as a new device or a new paradigm. It's meant to sort of bring the existing paradigm into somewhat of a tablet form factor, something that can function as a tablet if you want it to, but they seem to be really telling you, we think you should probably use this in a lot of ways like you use your laptop. And that, I think, lends itself to that sort of mentality that Ballmer's talking about of, this is meant to get work done. And it goes through, of course, to the operating system. Now, this current version is the RT version, which I guess is a lighter version of the Windows operating system. They're going to have a Pro version that runs full Windows 8. But in essence, Windows RT looks a lot like Windows 8. You can go in and get a standard desktop. If you've ever seen it or worked with it a little bit, you'll realize that it's got sort of the tile interface that's meant to be the tablet interface, but then you can also drop down into something that looks like your more standard Windows desktop with an Explorer and stuff like that. In using that, I found it kind of difficult to click on things. A lot of the elements were really small. You could tell, once again, it was really designed as a desktop operating system for a larger screen. The tile version of the OS is really meant to be sort of the tablet interface, but because you can jump back and forth, and this is what I call the sort of bipolar nature of the operating system, it just doesn't feel like you're ever really knowing how you're supposed to interact with it. And we brought up, you know, Microsoft Office, which is included with it. And that's one of the big selling points of this thing, I think, for a lot of people, is that it's got Office on it. And as far as I know, it's the only tablet that has, quote unquote, Microsoft Office on it. So they're going to sell a lot just for that reason alone. And, you know, when we get down to that work versus play aspect of current tablets, so looking at the iPad, looking at some of the competitive devices, I find it interesting, and in some ways it's kind of an accurate comment, but the thing is it's not accurate because the devices are limited. I think it's accurate because of the human limitation, just the limitations on our thinking about the current generation of tablets, things like the iPad and the competitive tablets, the competitive Android tablets. And yes, there's some technical challenges, but I think today's tablets can already function as amazing content creation and amazing work devices. And there's literally hundreds of examples of literature, of films, of music, of photography, of art, all being 100% produced on iPads. There's people doing it all the time, every day. So business is being done on iPads. people are also doing what most of us would think of as more traditional business tasks. Things like invoicing, point of sale systems are being built. Square is doing some amazing things with building point of sale into iPads. We're doing scheduling. We're doing all kinds of training. There's a lot of training happening on iPads and tablets. Communications, things like Skype, things like GoToMeeting. All these sorts of technologies that are used for business are being done on tablets and on iPads. So really, the only place that I can sort of agree with Ballmer that isn't necessarily taking off on tablets is Office. And I mean specifically Microsoft Office tasks. And that's mainly a Microsoft issue. They just haven't made the software available for anybody, right? They're holding that back. And of course, it's likely because they want to sell Surface tablets to people. There's no Office for iPad, and corporations and workers are kind of stuck on that. So they're sort of making their own argument to a certain degree. And that reliance or that feeling like we have to have Office to get business tasks done, that's really old thinking, and it's a generational issue to a certain degree. The iWork suite on iOS provides a valid and very capable version of Office, or Office, quote-unquote, Office solution. And now I'm using that Office term in more general things. You know, getting work done on an iOS device, you can do that with iWork. You can do spreadsheets and numbers. You can do word processing in Pages. It's just a matter of using the tool and saying, I'm going to use this tool versus that tool to do the same sorts of tasks. And so really the problem is learning to use the new tools, learning to use the new user interface on a new device, a device that's designed for touch. Yes, the tools are currently limited, but that's going to change as usage grows, right? I have to say I'm personally guilty of this. I have Pages on my iOS device. I haven't had a need or a reason to learn it, but I'm not in that sort of Office, quote-unquote, Office environment. I work for myself, and so I'm able to use other tools, things like Textastic or now Byword, and use Markdown. We've talked about, you know, that I'm moving more and more to using Markdown, less and less of using something like an Office-style word processor. But that's because I'm able to do that. If I had to use those sorts of tools, there would be a reason to learn them. It's a little bit of a chicken and an egg problem, right? You have to sort of move into the new tools and start using them, but a lot of people are afraid to start using them because they're different. It's a different form factor. And that's what, when I come back to this sort of generational problem, right? We've grown up with desktops and laptops, but the next generation is going to grow up with tablets. Our children are not going to have those sort of hangups saying, well, office work has to be done on this thing and with this type of application. They're going to be more willing to use the new devices and to learn the new skills that it takes to become efficient and work with those platforms better and these new platforms and devices. So more and more content creation, I think, is naturally going to start being done on tablets with the new tools, and they're going to become more effective as those new generations of people learn the skills and the workflows that work. It's that work on those style of devices. It's this natural progression of technology. So the difference between Apple's approach and Microsoft's approach really is, when you get down to it, that Apple is choosing to envision the future where a tablet or some sort of new form factor of device supersedes and becomes the new thing that replaces the PC. Tim Cook, if you listen to him, he believes it fully. He believes that the tablet and the iPad is going to replace the traditional PC in most cases over time. Microsoft seems to feel the need to offer some sort of device that bridges the gap between the old and the new, sort of trying to help their existing customer base come into the future. So which approach is better? I think you can't argue one against the other. There's one approach and there's the other approach. I do think in the long run, Apple's approach is more the right approach to take, because they're going to be developing next generation devices that are ready for the next generation as they move up and they move into the workforce. Whereas Microsoft is bringing along an aging demographic, you know, the old school guys, guys like us who have used PCs, and more specifically, people who are using Office in their day-to-day jobs now, they're going to bring them over and bring them onto a tablet with Office. But it's sort of this version that doesn't really work for the tablet, and when they have to then go and change it and change the paradigm, they're still going to end up upsetting those existing customers, and those aren't going to be the ones that are buying their devices in the future. So they're not really building for the future the way Apple is, at least the way I see it. So Ballmer's argument about not having a tablet that's for work or play really ultimately, in my mind, ends up being inaccurate, because we have the devices that we need to now. It's more just us changing the way we do work, changing the way we do our thinking, and that is somewhat of a slow process. It's going to happen naturally, and it's going to progress over time. It's already happening for me. I don't know if it's happening for you, but I'm doing more and more work on my tablets. I'm learning how to use that paradigm, but I'm not having to be coddled or babied into moving into that. So while Ballmer seems to think this is a technology problem that needs to be solving, I think once again, in my mind, and maybe even in Apple's view, this is more a human condition that needs to sort of change. We need to realize that we can use these devices in new ways to do amazing new things. And Apple's putting a little more faith in the customer, I think. Ballmer's feeling like we've need to sort of pull customers along and show them the way. And I don't know that it's, you know, one approach is better than the other. They're just different approaches. And I think it's time will tell which one ultimately proves successful. I think in Apple's case, it's going to be a little bit easier to be ready for the new customers who grew up with tablets and know how all this stuff works. I think they're going to be ahead of the game in terms of delivering the right user interface experiences, the right technologies, the right software, whereas Microsoft's still trying to cling on to some of these old paradigms, and maybe they have a second backup plan. Maybe there's a transition where they flip and now they're ready with a whole new thing. And maybe that's a little bit of what we're seeing with the sort of tile interface of Windows 8, or I forget what they call that interface, but the tablet interface, and maybe they have a whole plan for that. But right now, I'm just not seeing it, having played around with the device. So that just got me thinking this week, and those comments sort of triggered me wanting to talk about this. I hope I haven't rambled on and just made no sense. If you think I didn't make any sense or you totally disagree with me, send me some feedback. If you agree with me, if you had a chance to play with the Surface versus the iPad, let me know your thoughts and opinions, and we'll try and share those on a future episode. One of the big new enhancements of the iPhone 5 and its cellular chipsets, and also the cellular chips that are in the new iPad, the fourth generation iPad, as well as the LTE versions of the iPad mini, is they support globally more regions, more bands, more frequencies, and that means there are more and more these sort of global devices that you can take all over the world. Of course, one of those problems tends to be which carrier with and sort of the technology. Well, I got this great comment from Darren, who recently had a chance to test this out in a way.
Hi, Adam. This is Darren from Boston, Massachusetts, a longtime listener and fan of the show. And I'm currently vacationing in the UK, and I just wanted to give you some feedback on my experiences with my Verizon iPhone 5. I ordered a O2 Nano SIM card prior to leaving Boston, and had it delivered to the address where I would be staying in the UK, because I wanted to use a card and I didn't want to get stung with any roaming fees or international charges, and just wanted a cheap, simple plan. The O2 plan that I found is actually quite impressive. It's £20, which gives you 250 minutes in the UK, 2,500 texts within the UK, and 250 megabytes. This is on a 3G network. It's excellent. It's worked great. I'm really, really pleased with it. To say this is just a pay-and-go tariff, or pay-and-go-go-go, as they call it. Like I say, works great. Really pleased with it. did have to call and get everything activated to O2 themselves, and I had a couple of questions when I started, but yeah, it's really good. It stays with you for a month. Obviously, I'm going to be here like a couple of weeks. So after speaking to somebody, the £20 balance does end at the end of the month, which isn't a problem because I'll be back in the US. But if I need to keep this going, all I have to do is make one phone call from the US. Within 5 months, it doesn't cancel my SIM card or my account with them. And so the next time I come over, I'll be able to use the same SIM. Like I say, very happy with it. Works really well. And also, just want a word on maps. I know it's had a lot of bad press at the moment, but I've been using it in Massachusetts a lot, and it's worked really well. Really, really pleased with it. And I thought I'd give it a go over here because maybe it's different in the UK. So far, I've got to say, it's been really good. I've been using it as a GPS, and I've driven from the south of England to the Midlands, and it's been very accurate. Really, really pleased with it. Anyway, I just wanted to give you that little bit of info. Thanks again for the show, and speak to you later. Bye.
Hey, thanks, Darren. I appreciate the information. Yeah, it's nice to hear some good things about Apple's map application from somebody else other than me. I've been saying this working pretty well for me. I know that there's specific pockets and specific areas, but in general, the feedback I'm getting from you is that it's working pretty well for at least most of you. So, Darren, you seem to be backing that up. And it's great to hear how sort of the international stuff is working. You know, I think you mentioned you have a Verizon iPhone 5, and I think that's the best choice if you're looking at an iPhone 5 and you want to use it globally. And that reason is one, that Verizon, out of the box, reportedly has iPhone 5s globally unlocked, meaning that you can order a SIM from a place like O2 and actually just pop that right into your device when you get over there. I think Sprint will also unlock them, but for them, you have to wait 90 days after you've purchased the phone and activated service. AT&T does not, as far as I know, let you unlock the device until you are off your contract. So you can either buy it off contract, which is very expensive, or they just require that you use one of their expensive international mobile data plans. Certainly not as affordable as the O2 pay-as-you-go-go-go plan that you mentioned there. And the other advantage of getting a Verizon iPhone 5 is that LTE is starting to deploy out in parts of Europe. I know you mentioned, Darren, that you were using 3G data, but LTE is becoming available, and it looks like from the specs, the Verizon iPhone 5 supports more of the LTE frequencies and bands. So I'm thinking that anybody who wants to travel internationally probably wants to end up on Verizon so that they can take advantage of some of the things that you were able to take advantage of, as well as potentially in the future use more of the LTE stuff. So once again, thanks, Darren, for your comment. Now I have a pretty cool little trick for you. And I say it's pretty cool. I think a lot of you are going to think that it is very cool. I actually thought it was very cool, to be honest, if not a little bit scary. And we'll talk about that side of this tip in a second. But, you know, one of the complaints about iOS is that Apple installs by default different applications, things like Stocks and Compass and Weather, and there may or may not be people that get value out of those applications. And it's not so much that Apple includes them as it is that you can't remove them. You cannot remove any of the stock Apple applications that they ship with iOS. And a lot of people don't like that. They like to be able to remove them. And, you know, a common tip or trick is, well, you know, put them in a folder and put them way at the end or off on the screen by themselves so they're not with your other applications. In essence, sort of hiding them, but you can never really hide them. And the Cult of Mac this week had a great story and tip that actually offered a method to remove or hide any of the Apple installed built-in applications from your iOS device, and to be able to do it without a jailbreak. Historically, you could do it if you jailbroke your phone, but a lot of us don't like to do that, myself included. And this tip uses a hack from a website called CediaHacks.com. And so you need to access CediaHacks.com from your Safari on your phone. So you have to use mobile Safari. And once you go there, then you can find the buttons and links for sort of turning off the different applications that are built in. And they recently updated this hack, and this is the article that I saw, with a new link. So when you go to cediahacks.com now, you'll notice something that says install pass hack. And what this is a passbook, quote unquote, pass that gets added to your passbook application. And once you have that added to your passbook, you can go in and you can open up the pass and you can click on the little eye, the little info button. It'll flip around and you can scroll through and you can see all of the links on cediahacks.com that will allow you to once again remove or hide the built-in applications. So in my case, I tried this out. One app that I never use is the Stocks application. So they have a little link in that pass to turn off the Stocks application. So I click on that. And what it does is it prompts you and says it would like to install a new package. And you have to go ahead and click the install button. And it will start to overwrite the Stocks application and then throw an error message. It'll say something like unable to download application. And you click done on that. And then what you'll notice on your home screen is that whatever application you were attempting to replace will have a progress bar on it, like it's still trying to download, but it'll be incomplete. And at this point now, you can actually press and hold on the icon, put it into wiggle mode, and you will get the little X button to actually remove the application. So you can hit that, and at that point, it'll remove the application from your device. And this works until you need to restart your device. So another good thing about this tip is you can actually get these applications back once again, without having to do any kind of hacking or jailbreaking. All you have to do is restart your device and the default applications will come back. So that's good and bad, because if you don't want that application and you've had for some reason to restart your device, you're going to have to re-implement this hack. But that's why they added this pass hack passbook pass, because now you can go in, you can simply just redo the same steps, but very quickly, all from this little pass. And so I thought that was pretty cool. If you're running an older device, if you're not running iOS 6 and you don't have Passbook, you can still go to the CediaHacks.com page from Safari and perform the same procedures. All the links are in there. It just takes a few more steps. So having the Passbook thing is a little bit quicker. Now that I've given you this tip, I'm going to give you the big caveat. I did try this on my phone. It does work as advertised, but you are hacking your device and you're doing it through accessing content from a third-party website. I know nothing about cediahacks.com. I don't know the people who are running it. It seems to work fine, but you need to use discretion and caution whether or not, you know, in sort of deciding if it's worth the possible risks to get these applications off your device using this hack. It does seem to be safe and relatively benign, but I really don't know what's going on behind the scenes to make this hack work. And I would caution you that this is normally exactly the kind of link-clicking behavior that I would warn you against. So I'm telling you how to do it because I thought it was interesting information. I know a lot of people want to know how to do this sort of thing. It doesn't require a jailbreak, so I think it's cool for all of those reasons, but there's your little word of caution. So if something bad happens, just know that you're doing behavior that could potentially cause something bad to happen, and you're doing it at your own risk. All right, have I covered my butt on that one? Anyway, still a cool tip. Now, here's something that's not so cool. It's a bug, and it's something that I've run into. I actually posted something on Apple's discussion forums, or found a discussion thread on Apple's forums of somebody having the same sort of issue, or a few people having the same sort of issue, and it's an iTunes Match issue. I love iTunes Match. I wasn't so sure about it when I first signed up about a year ago. It's actually been less than a year, and that's the root of this problem. I've been using iTunes Match when I got my new iPhone 5 and iOS 6, I suddenly started having this problem where iTunes Match kept telling me that my iTunes Match subscription was expired, even though it wasn't, and I wasn't able to access my music. So that's not very cool. And Rob sounds like he's having the same sort of issue.
Hey, Adam, this is Rob, and I read your thread on the Apple support about the problem I'm having is iTunes Match. It works over Wi-Fi, but when I go out of Wi-Fi and I'm on LTE or what AT&T calls 4G, it says my subscription's expired or I need, and it's not. I have automatic renewal. In fact, on the 14th of this month, and I called Apple support. They really didn't have a solution for it. They moved me up to a second-tier tech, and he was going to check into it. He left me his contact number and an email address. I gave him mine, and if he hears anything, it might be a bug in iOS 6. And if 6.1 can fix it, he'll be contacting me to see if they're aware of it. But anyway, it seems that there will be quite a few people who are having this trouble, something you might address on the MacCast. And I think you're aware of it, and you might bring it up on a MacCast.
Yep, I'm going to bring it up, Rob, because it's actually something, as you noted, that I'm dealing with. It's really frustrating, and I'm sure there's others out there who may have run across this problem. So I want to point it out. And what's actually happening is that with iTunes Match on my iPhone 5, just like Rob described, I'm on AT&T, and everything is fine as long as I'm on Wi-Fi. I can stream all my music, I can access all my music, but it seems like the minute I go out and I'm on LTE specifically, I will eventually, sometimes it works up to a certain point, but at some point it will pop up this message and say, your iTunes Match subscription is expired. And then you have no longer any access to your music. And my subscription doesn't expire until December. And it works fine. Music Match works fine, or iTunes Match works fine on all of my Macs, on any device that I'm on Wi-Fi with, as long as I'm not on the cellular data network. And there is an ever-growing support thread on Apple.com. I'll have a link to it in the show notes at MacCast.com. Rob, I too also called AppleCare, and I'm going through their support. I've been escalated up to another engineer, and they are reportedly looking into it. I haven't heard anything back from them yet. But a common theme seems to be, and I have not confirmed this, that it's iPhone 5s on AT&T with LTE. Those seem to be the trifecta of things. Well, and of course, that you're using iTunes Match. The four things that need to happen before you see this bug. Now, I think mine has been fixed, though, with the iOS 6.0.1 update. And I don't know if it's related or not to the consolidating of the iTunes Match switch. You remember I mentioned earlier with the iOS 6 update that it used to be in two places in the settings. Now it's just in the one place. I don't know if some of the tweaking there happened, but I did notice that I can get on the LTE network, I can use iTunes Match, and I don't get the expiration message yet. Now, I'm a bit cautious on this because over on the support thread, even people who have upgraded to iOS 6.0.1 are reporting that they're still getting the same issue. And with my testing, I've only been testing at home. I haven't gone out and about. So this might be related to some sort of cellular handshake, handoff sort of thing as you move from tower to tower, because the only time I've ever noticed the problem is when I'm on cellular, but also when I'm driving in the car and I'm sort of moving around. And I would assume at that point I'm hopping from cell tower to cell tower, and that may be what's throwing it off. I have no idea. I have no hard proof of that, but that's one of my theories. So I'm cautiously optimistic that iOS 6.0.1 may have fixed the issue, but I'm not entirely convinced. So if any of you have had this same issue with iTunes Match, go over to MacCast.com, go to the show notes, and follow the link to the support thread and post your experiences there, because the more and more people that point out that there's a problem, maybe the quicker that Apple will jump on and issue a fix for for this iTunes Match issue. And it's frustrating because I'd like to complain, and I think they need to actually refund some money or at least extend the iTunes Match subscriptions for those people who've been affected, because, you know, we're paying for this service and you literally, when this happens, you can't access it. You have no access to your music, which completely defeats the whole purpose of iTunes Match. So just throwing it out there, and thanks, Rob, for the comment. And then finally, the last thing I have to talk to you about today is, you know, while Apple's latest Macs are all shedding their optical drives, apparently there's still a lot of you who use those little plastic round thingies. A couple of people this week, two or three actually, emailed me specifically about burning DVDs on their Mac, and the questions are, what tools can I use to burn DVDs? And specifically, people wanting to take their home movies and turn those into a DVD that they could put into a DVD player. More specifically, turn those into a disc that they could put into a Blu-ray player. So a lot of people want to know, can I burn a Blu-ray disc with menus and all my videos and stuff like that on it in the Mac or on my Mac? And what's the best software? How can I do that? And of course, you're going to need an optical drive in your Mac. And so if you don't have one built in, if you don't have a built-in super drive, you can get the external super drive. And that works with MacBook Pros with Retina displays, MacBook Airs, Mac Minis, and the soon-to-be-out iMacs that don't have optical drives built in. That's a USB super drive that you can get from Apple. You can also get a third-party external optical drive. OWC sells them, and they even have Blu-ray drives, external Blu-ray drives that use USB that you can get for less than $100. So if you want to do and burn, create and burn Blu-ray discs, that's the best way to go. Their website's MacSales.com. You can check out the models there. I know there's other models out on the market, but I like OWC, and you're pretty much guaranteed if you get it from them that it is going to work. So luckily, if you still have a copy of iDVD or the old retail boxed copy of iLife 11, which still has iDVD, I think version 7 in it, you could install and use that to burn your DVDs. And this would be standard DVDs, not Blu-ray discs. For Blu-ray, you're going to need a different tool. But if you have iDVD, I still think that's the best way to burn a DVD that has menus. You can take your project from iMovie, you can funnel it right into iDVD. It works great. They've got really nicely designed themes that look great. And that seems to be the biggest deficiency in my mind with some of the other products that are out there, is getting really good looking DVD menus. I think Apple has some of the best designs out there. But in the research that I was doing, there might be a workflow where you could use Final Cut Pro 10, Compressor 4, which are both available on the Mac App Store, and then a burning tool like Titanium Toast. The problem with this is, one, you need three different applications, it's expensive, and the workflow to me seems pretty convoluted, and I couldn't even tell whether or not you would end up with a nicely designed custom DVD menu using this process. It seemed like you'd end up with a pretty generic DVD or Blu-ray disc. The good news is that that workflow does support burning to a Blu-ray disc, so you could end up with a movie on a Blu-ray disc. I just don't know that you'll get the menus, and I wasn't able to confirm that. There was no good instructions, no good screenshots, so you can see why I'm not really recommending that solution. Another solution that seemed really viable, and probably the route that most pros are going, is Adobe has DVD and Blu-ray authoring tools, the tool called Encore, that's part of the CS suite. The only problem with that is that it's part of the Production Premiere suite, which costs about $1,800 US. So it's definitely not cheap. You could actually get it by subscribing to the new Adobe Cloud product, which I think runs $49 a month if you buy a year subscription up front. So you're looking at just under $600, about $588. Cheaper than $1,800, but still very expensive. But if you're looking for, you know, really professional video editing and DVD creation, Blu-ray creation tools, that's probably the suite to get your hands on. But my guess is that the most cost-effective and easiest solution would be to get Adobe's Premiere Elements software, which is available on the Mac App Store. It's $79 US, so about 80 bucks, and it will let you do everything all in one. You can do your video editing, you can do all of your menus for your DVD, you can do the compression and the burning all from a single application. About the only limitation I could see is that the themes that you're going to have, you have somewhat limited choices. You either like what Adobe has designed or you don't. I don't know that there's a whole lot of customization you can do, but that seems to be the way to go. If I were to pick an application for creating DVDs and Blu-ray discs, I'd go with Adobe Premiere Elements at this point. Frankly, though, I've found that I don't burn discs anymore. I just end up generating digital files and sharing and sending those, putting them up on a service like Vimeo or YouTube, and that's how I get my videos out there. But I know a lot of people still like to burn the discs, and so there's a couple ways that you can do that. And if you have a suggestion, if you have a workflow for creating DVDs and more specifically Blu-rays with really nicely designed menus, a piece of software that maybe I missed, please send that information along, because I had a hard time on this one finding solutions. So with that, that's going to do it for this episode of the MacCast. Before I leave you, I do want to take a quick moment and thank all of my show sponsors, Circus Ponies, makers of Notebook. You can check out their software, get more information and details, as well as free trials over at circusponies.com. Smile, makers of Text Expander, PDF Pen, Disc Label, PDF Pen for iPad and iPhone, and Text Expander Touch. You can get information on all their software, as well as free trials of their Mac applications over at smilesoftware.com. Gazelle, the fast and simple way to sell your used iPhones, iPads, MacBooks, and other smartphones. Find out what your gadget is worth at gazelle.com. And Citrix, try out GoToMeeting with HD Faces, free for 30 days. Just visit gotomeeting.com, click on the Try It Now link, and be sure to enter the code MACCAST. And big thank you to all of my sponsors for their support of the show. Big thank you to you for your support. Please keep your emails, your audio comments coming. I love hearing from you. You can send those to maccast@gmail.com, or you can call in on the listener hotline and leave a voicemail. That number is 281-622-4269, 281-MAC-IAM-9. Please leave your email address if you do leave a comment, in case I need to follow up with you. Also, you can leave voicemail on Skype. My Skype address is the MacCast. And be sure to check out the website, maccast.com. There you'll find show notes with links to everything that I talked about in this or any other episode of the MacCast. And while you're there, be sure to check out the forum at forum.maccast.com. You can also follow me on Twitter, twitter.com/MacCast, or check out the Facebook page over at facebook.com/TheMacCast. That's going to do it for now. Until next time, I will talk to you all again real soon.